Lecture 6, Transforming the Ideology into Policy.
I'd like to proceed in this session to talk about the emergence of National Socialist ideology in terms of National Socialist policy. One of the problems about any kind of regime is how one actually translates ideology into policy. A question that has really haunted the study of National Socialism and has become extremely important in recent years is a debate really that centers on if one knows the ideology, if one knows the ideological core of National Socialism, are the policy outcomes then absolutely predictable? And the way this is often phrased is, Auschwitz may be a logical culmination of National Socialist ideology, but is it the inevitable outcome of National Socialist ideology? What I'd like to do in this session is to talk about the emergence of National Socialist racial policy in the period before the outbreak of the Second World War, to trace its the steps in the translation of Nazi anti-Semitism into policy for the German state. For over a year after the Nazi seizure of power, the party, while certainly giving signals about its ideological objectives, was absorbed in establishing and consolidating its power, establishing the system that would guarantee it a position from which to move, to implement ideological policy. It was concerned to construct the foundations of a state with totalitarian aspirations, as we've seen. It would only really be in 1935 that the clear direction of Nazi policy would emerge, both in terms of foreign policy and in domestic policy. What I would like to do in this session is to look at domestic policy, particularly racial policy, and then to talk about foreign policy in the next session, and then to try to link them together. The NSDAP had, from the very beginning, been an anti-Semitic political organization. Anti-Semitism stood at the center of Nazi ideology. It stood at the center of the initial program of the DAP in 1919 and was certainly an integral part of the 25 points that Hitler drafted in 1920. Mein Kampf drips with the most radical kind of racial anti-Semitism. And National Socialist propaganda before 1933 certainly was awash in anti-Semitism. The Nazis had never made any attempt to hide their anti-Semitism. But before 1933, anti-Semitism had simply been one of a number of things that the party had emphasized. It had been, as you'll recall, anti-Marxist, anti-big business, and so on. The NSDAP before 1933 had made a very hard-headed political calculation with regard to anti-Semitism. It was that anti-Semitism as an issue by itself was not enough to make the NSDAP a mass party, that you could count on getting your 2 to 3, maybe 4 or 5% at the most, of the sort of lunatic fringe of German politics to support a program that was essentially based on anti-Semitism. But by itself, it simply wouldn't work. There had been anti-Semitic parties in Germany before the First World War. They had come into being in the early 1890s. By 1912, they had virtually all vanished, unable to establish any sort of lasting constituency. If one charts the content of Nazi political propaganda, anti-Semitism is far more prevalent in their propaganda between 1920 and 1928, when the party doesn't get much of a vote, than it is between 28 and 32. It isn't because the Nazis became less anti-Semitic. It is simply that the anti-Semitism was linked to other issues between 28 and 32 in a far more subtle fashion than it had been before. But certainly, I think for most Germans, it would have been absolutely impossible for anybody in Germany to have thought that the NSDAP was not anti-Semitic or not to have known about this aspect of its appeal. And yet, I think for most Germans, it came as a surprise that whereas the Nazis broke all kinds of promises, promises that they had made to small farmers, promises that they had made to small shopkeepers, promises that they had made to any number of their constituents having to do with economic and social matters, some of which we'll come to touch upon in a moment, it would have come as a surprise that the aspect of Nazi propaganda before 33 that the Nazis did care about and that the Nazis would attempt to implement was the anti-Semitic element of that propaganda. Again, it wasn't because it was hidden. It was always there. It was always in view. It was not so much a matter of it being disguised as people having a difficult time determining which of these various contradictory promises that the Nazis made in this catch-all appeal that they had that they actually were serious about. It would, however, emerge quite clearly as the ideological core of National Socialist policy in the Third Reich. There are quite distinct phases in the evolution of Nazi Jewish policy that we want to talk about. Very quickly, the first phase from 1933 to 1935, I'll run through these phases and then we'll come back and talk about them in some detail. Between 33 and 35, one sees a boycott of Jewish businesses in April of 1933, legislation enacted in the spring of 33 to eliminate Jews from the civil service, law, medicine, and so on. And most prominently in this early period from 33 to 35, what were called Einzelaktionen, individual actions by local SA or regional SA units against Jews. Between 35 and 38, a new phase developed in Nazi Jewish policy. Initiated by the enactment in the fall of 1935 of the so-called Nuremberg Laws. Laws drafted at the Nuremberg Party rally in that year, which essentially deprived Jews of their civil rights and made Jews non-citizens in Germany. It is the beginning of the forced segregation of the Jewish community in Germany. It also was the first systematic attempt to begin to define what being Jewish actually was. How did one define who was Jewish and who was not, according to Nazi racial laws? That period would be followed in 1938, in a period from 38 down to 1941, with a new departure, the first clearly government-ordered mass act of violence against the Jewish community in Germany, the so-called Night of Broken Glass, the Kristallnacht, in November of 1938, would initiate a whole new ominous and sinister phase of Nazi racial policy. In 1938, the regime would begin to seize Jewish assets and to move to eliminate Jews from German economic life all across the board. To continue the policy of immigration, which now would become dispossession and deportation or forced expulsion, followed in late 41 and then from late 41 to the end of the Second World War, the National Socialists adopt the policy of mass extermination of the Jewish community of Europe. We want to trace the evolution of Nazi racial policy in this period before the outbreak of the war in this session. The first measures undertaken by the regime would come in April of 1933. On April 1st, the Nazis had called for a boycott of all Jewish businesses in Germany. SA troops were stationed out in front of Jewish shops all over the country. With the humiliation of Jewish shopkeepers and the harassment of people that tried to trade at Jewish shops on that day. The boycott proved to be tremendously unpopular both at home and abroad. The regime was embarrassed in Germany because of these scenes of harassment of Jewish shopkeepers by these SA bully boys out in front of shops. Embarrassed internationally because of the international press's coverage of the boycott and the reaction of Jewish groups, particularly in the United States, to this initiative in Nazi policy. Hitler backed off The boycott, which was to last indefinitely, was called off in less than 48 hours. Hitler argued that it was necessary to initiate the boycott to somehow temper the fury of the German population at the Jews. The actual boycott itself proved to have quite a different impact on the German population. After this boycott of Jewish shops, and as I said, regional variation is important here. In some areas of Germany, particularly in the area of Franconia, the boycott of Jewish businesses continued after the after it was called off. If you were Jewish, where you lived in Germany was extremely important. There were great variations in the way that one could live from Gau to Gau or region to region. The national leadership, however, also in the spring of 1933, introduced legislation to remove Jews from the civil service, from the courts, newspapers, universities, and other cultural institutions. And having been given the signal by the regime, some universities and other institutions in German public life vied with one another to dismiss Jews to show that they had good National Socialist credentials. So all it took in some ways was a kind of signal from the regime, and a whole series of institutions fell very quickly into line. Hindenburg was so upset by the dismissal of some Jews from the civil service, war veterans, distinguished veterans from the First World War. But Hindenburg actually stirred himself from his lethargy, wrote Hitler a note saying basically, you have to stop this. We can't allow Jewish veterans to be treated like this. And Hitler actually made an exception in the case of Jewish veterans, as long at least as Hindenburg was alive. The April 7th law, the law for the restoration of a professional civil service, removed all, quote, non-Aryans. Now, what was a non-Aryan? The way the law was defined in the spring of 1933 was that anyone with one Jewish grandparent was considered to be a non-Aryan. The decree also blocked admission to the bar for Jews, and also the practice of medicine in state clinics and social security programs where most Germans received their medical care. The regime also introduced a law for the overcrowding of German schools and institutions of higher learning, in which a quota was set at 1.5% for Jewish participation or attendance at these schools and other institutions of higher learning. There was also a law introduced entitled the Law on Revocation of Naturalization and Annulment of German Citizenship. All these sound very ponderous and pompous. In July of 1933, which removed the citizenship of naturalized Eastern European Jews who had moved into Germany during the Weimar years, escaping persecution in the East. Their citizenship was now revoked by the National Socialist regime. And finally, in September of 1933, the regime introduced a law called the Hereditary Farm Law, which stipulated that no one could inherit a farm unless they could show no Jewish blood back to the year 1800. I think what this was a clear attempt to show to the farm community that the Nazis were interested in making sure that only real Germans could own land. But I can't imagine that this law had very much of an impact. It was, however, an indication of the ideological direction of National Socialist policy. Nonetheless, after this initial burst of activity in 1933, there would be no major innovations at the national level in Jewish policy in 1933, in 1934, or into 1935. After this package of legislation was introduced, at the national level at any rate, the regime seemed to lose interest in racial policy, in part because I think Hitler was clearly concentrating on other matters that we've just discussed in the first session here. But in this period, what one sees are individual actions, what were called Einzelaktionen, undertaken at the grassroots level by party radicals and particularly by the SA. These were sporadic acts of violence and public humiliations of Jews, undertaken without any sort of authorization from Berlin or from Munich party headquarters, where local radicals simply went on a rampage, in many cases quite violent, against Jews. Again, this is why I said, where you lived, if you were Jewish in Germany, made a considerable amount of difference. But as these Einsatzaktionen, many of which were brutal and incredibly ugly, were occurring, action at the Reich level actually subsided. However, during the summer of 1935, these Einzelaktionen seemed to accelerate during the spring and early summer. Jews in many areas of Germany were being prevented from going to the theaters, from swimming pools or vacation resorts. Small businesses, Aryan businesses, were now being hurt, and public opinion were, in many cases, the Gestapo reports make quite clear, public opinion was revolted by the boycotts and the general sort of terror in the streets. The SA was becoming an embarrassment. This kind of public humiliation was, in a sense, tacky. It was too overt, too open, too plebeian. And something had to be done about this. The initiative for these Einzelaktionen clearly came from local militants who were frustrated by the regime's foot-dragging. There was a lot of complaint within the SA in this period about the regime's loss of direction in racial policy. The regime was going too slow for the radicals. And yet at the same time, the regime was reluctant to intervene to try to bring these SA radicals under control. The Einzelaktionen, these individual actions, were useful for the regime as a means of diverting militant attention away from the regime's failure to move, to take bolder action against the Jews. It was a safety valve in a way. And particularly after the purge of the SA in the summer of 34, these kinds of Einzelaktionen were seen as a kind of new mission for the SA that they could do in a way that wouldn't really terribly disturb the regime. When state officials tried to stop these Einzelaktionen, and when it does get National Socialist officials such as Frick complaining about the breach of public order, the response from the radicals within the party in the SA is, I think, aptly captured by one local Nazi who said, quote, "We old Nazis don't give a damn about the remarks of some Nazi bigwig. As far as we're concerned, all we have to do is to fulfill the program as the Fuhrer wishes." So what these Einzelaktionen did was to, in a sense, give the SA a sense that they really understood what the Fuhrer wanted, and even though Frick and the Nazis in the state were trying to rein them in, they understood. Nonetheless, the SS was increasingly concerned about these breaches of public order. In the SS publication, The Black Corps, the SS had these black uniforms as opposed to the SA's brown. In 1935, the Black Corps editorialized, and I quote, "The Jewish question is one of our people's most burning problems, but it will not be solved by terror in the streets," close quote. Frick, the Minister of the Interior, was now forced to order the state to intervene ruthlessly against the illegal actions against the Jews, and indeed a number of SA leaders were actually arrested by state officials because of their refusal to comply with these orders. In the summer of 1935, these SA actions were threatening to embarrass the regime, particularly because on the horizon, of course, was the 1936 Olympics to be held in Germany. The last thing the regime wanted to see as the press of the world descended upon Germany was a group of SA bullies dragging a Jewish shopkeeper out in front of a store and beating him or her up. So the regime felt that it had to move somehow to bring these things under control. Pressure was mounting to bring the situation under control, and especially on the regime to enact some sort of legislation, Jewish legislation, if it wanted to prevent further acts of terror against the Jews. As a consequence, in the fall of 1935, at the Nuremberg Party rally, the regime would indeed take action to enact new legislation on the Jewish question. The Nuremberg Laws in 1935 were a major watershed in the evolution of Nazi racial policy, a major step on the way to the Holocaust. Many historians have interpreted this as part of an overarching kind of game plan, a strategy. First, the sort of boycotts, then the 35 Nuremberg laws, which would deprive Jews of their citizenship and their basic civil rights, a ratcheting up in 1938 to violence against Jews in the form of the Kristallnacht, the economic expropriation of Jews, and then finally, with the beginning of the war, the physical extermination of the Jewish population. That makes a great deal of sense, and there's evidence to suggest that this is in fact the case. And yet there's also evidence to suggest that much of this legislation, much of these actions were taken in the same kind of improvisational manner that the Nazis tended to proceed about virtually everything. For example, the Nuremberg Laws. There was pressure for Hitler to take some sort of action, to take some sort of legal action, to rein in the SA, but at the same time to continue the anti-Semitic momentum of the regime. Hitler went to the Nuremberg Party rally, which would take place between September 9th and 15th, fully intending on the final day of the rally to give a big foreign policy speech. The great denouement of every Nuremberg rally was Hitler's address on the final day. Hitler decided, while already in Nuremberg, at the very last moment, and unexpectedly, that what he wanted to do was to change his speech. He didn't want to talk about foreign policy. Instead, he told his advisors on the 13th that what he wanted to do 2 days hence was to introduce a major new piece of legislation on the Jewish question. This sent Nazi operatives running in every direction, feverish phone calls to Berlin to check about the legal situation. One of the first drafts of the Nuremberg Laws was written on a paper napkin at a beer hall in Munich. Hitler wanted to have a dramatic close to the party rally on the 15th, a big speech to end the event. The work was done on the Nuremberg race laws was done almost exclusively by improvisation. Hitler got his big speech on the last day of the rally. Two sets of laws were announced at Nuremberg. The first, a law for the protection of German blood and German honor. Laws which forbade marriages and sexual relations between Aryans and non-Aryans. And a Reich citizenship law was announced but not promulgated until a bit later, which distinguished between a subject and a citizen. Jews could not be citizens henceforth of the Third Reich. 13 supplementary decrees down to 1943 would be necessary to complete the definition of who was Jewish, and this was not announced at Nuremberg, but clearly the intent now was to segregate the Jews as non-citizens of Germany, deprive them of their civil rights, and also to make clear that what the Nazis were dealing with here was a racial definition of Aryanism. The Reich citizenship law that was announced at Nuremberg, however, did not really stabilized the Jewish situation. Differences quickly arose between party and state over who, in fact, was a Jew. How did one define it? The party, and particularly Rudolf Hess, argued that one Jewish grandparent ought to be enough to establish one's Jewishness. In this instance, Hess was simply expressing the opinion held by radicals within the party. On the other hand, Foreign Office officials, Treasury officials, as well as people, other Nazis within the state, argued that this was too broad a definition and that their preferred definition of who was a Jew was someone with three Jewish grandparents. The debate raged all through the fall of 1935, both sides appealing to Hitler to make a decision. Something as close to Hitler's heart as this, it would seem, the Führer would have to make a decision. Typically, Hitler refused to intervene. On September 29th, he was supposed to make a decision at a gathering of Nazi party and state officials, but faced with this gathering, instead launched into a general talk about the history of Jews in Germany and didn't deal with the question at all. He concluded by saying that all remaining points would have to be cleared up by negotiations between party and state, and after a 2.5-hour harangue, walked out of the room. Negotiations continued. A conference was called for November 5th, in which, again, Hitler was supposed to make some sort of decision. Hitler canceled the meeting when it became clear that party and state officials had been unable to agree on this issue. In the end, the state position carried the day. The definition coming out of the Nuremberg Laws was anyone with three Jewish grandparents would be declared a Jew. Though there were then definitions of Mischling erster Grad, a mixture first class, second class, and so on. And as time passed, these definitions were broadened. The Nuremberg Laws certainly changed the position of Jews in Germany. Ironically enough, it produced a small trickle of reverse immigration of some Jews that actually came back to Germany after the passage of the Nuremberg Laws. Why? Because they believed that now the situation had been stabilized. There was a legal position, and although it was disgusting, it was at least a legal position, a legal framework in which they could live, and that these radical actions taken by the SA would now be illegal and would not would be curbed. For most Jews, however, the handwriting seemed to be on the wall. Jews were deprived of their political rights of citizenship. They couldn't vote, obviously, could not marry an Aryan, have sexual relations, and so on. Between 35 and 38, and after the passage of the Nuremberg Laws, once again the regime seemed to lose its momentum. The laws began to be implemented. It began the segregation of the Jewish community from, quote, Aryan Germans. But once again, policy seemed to lack a real direction. The central policy of the regime after 1935 was to encourage Jews to leave Germany for any destination that would accept them. Jews had become non-citizens, but the regime appeared to have no real sense of where to go beyond the Nuremberg Laws. The policy was Entjudung, a particularly ugly German word, which literally means, and I think the translation is, doesn't even begin to capture, as ugly as it is, the ugliness of the German term, is it means to de-Jewify Germany. Abuses of the laws were considerable. Jews seeking to immigrate had to sell, often to local party bosses. If you were Jewish and you were trying to leave Germany and you were able to get out and you were trying to sell your property, party bosses in particular moved in. The threat that they would somehow block your immigration was always there, and consequently Jews were forced to sell off what property they had at really cut rate. Rates. Goering, who is head of the four-year plan, a new plan adopted in 1936 to revitalize the German economy and put it on a wartime footing within the foreseeable future, was forced to intervene, complaining that these laws were not intended, as he put it, to act as a charitable scheme for incompetent party members. Between 35 then and 1938, one sees again this curious lack of momentum, an inability to sustain the momentum of legislation. But that would all change in 1938 when a new turn of events would intercede. In early 1938, the regime, now very much concerned about putting the German economy in order for some sort of foreign policy adventure, began to look at Jewish assets in Germany with a very covetous eye. On January 5, 1938, a law regarding change of family names and given names was introduced, followed up by similar laws throughout the summer that provided that all male Jews must now assume the name of Israel as a middle name and all Jewish females the name Sarah. Henceforth, all Jewish children born would have to adopt names that were quite clearly Jewish in origin for their identification by the regime. Jews were also now required to apply for identity cards, which they were to carry at all times, and on October 5th, all Jews were required to turn in their passports in order to have a J stamped quite prominently in them. The regime moved for identification here, Goering argued, because it wanted to do a real accounting of Jewish assets in Germany, in preparation, presumably, for the expropriation of the Jewish population. Indeed, the regime increasingly turned to Jewish economic life. Decrees on reporting of Jewish property were introduced in April of 1938. A law that made it illegal to, quote, camouflage Jewish businesses was introduced, so that the regime now began to look to see business, for businesses that Jews clearly owned, but also for other businesses in which Jews were stockholders. What percentage of the employees of a business were actually Jewish? Goering quite clearly had in mind the confiscation of Jewish business holdings in Germany. And yet it was a completely unforeseen event that would once again activate a radical turn in Nazi policy in November of 1938. In Paris, a distraught young Polish Jew whose family had immigrated to Germany in the 1920s, and then now had their naturalization papers revoked by the Nazis and were living in a camp because Poland didn't want to accept them, in his distress, shot a German official in the German embassy in Paris, a man by the name of Fumrad. Goebbels, attempting to curry favor with Hitler, to demonstrate to Hitler his own commitment to the cause. Goebbels had fallen into real disrepute with Hitler in early 1938, and Goebbels' own personal motivations were extremely important here. What came to be known as the Night of Broken Glass, the Kristallnacht of November 10th, 1938, was presented to the German public as, quote, the spontaneous answer of the German people to the assassination in Paris. All over Germany on that night, Jewish businesses, Jewish synagogues, Jewish homes were attacked by Nazis in plain clothes, not wearing party uniforms for the most part. The personnel that carried out the Kristallnacht did not come from the SS, nor for the most part did they come from the SA. They were recruited from Goebbels' propaganda ministry. It was a Goebbels show for the most part. Dozens of people lost their lives. Existences were destroyed by the Kristallnacht. And it was the first real nationally coordinated act of government-condoned violence against the Jewish community in Germany. With the Einsatzaktion, the regime had been able to sort of move the shells around and in some ways distance itself from these kinds of things. Kristallnacht was another matter. This was clearly an action undertaken by the regime. And the response of the people of Germany, as reflected in the Gestapo reports, was unsettling to the government. The Gestapo reported, and this was also, I think, documented by the American ambassador and foreign diplomats in Germany, that the primary reaction of the population had been shock at the violence and destruction, the senseless destruction of property in particular, a reaction against the breach of law and order, clearly now driven by the regime, and a public reaction against what was described as pogrom anti-Semitism. The regime drew very important conclusions from this reaction. Never again was violence against Jews to be public. Hitler, at this point, warned not to single out Jews by having them wear special badges. There was a widespread view, the Gestapo reported, that, quote, Hitler certainly wants the Jews to disappear from Germany, but he does not want them to be beaten to death or treated in such a fashion, close quote. The regime had overstepped itself. The population, it now believed, was not ready for this kind of activity, and therefore it had to be more careful. There was nothing like, and I have to emphasize this, there was nothing like real opposition in Germany to the Kristallnacht. No voices of outrage against the regime on moral grounds. And the upshot, after a few days of shock, was a greater isolation of the Jewish community in Germany. Jews were now forced into real isolation. The process of exclusion, dehumanization, would now continue without opposition. There was a growing sense that Nazi propaganda would be able to continue its work in the depiction of Jews as an alien element within German society. Goering certainly used the Kristallnacht as a pretext to expropriate Jewish businesses, and measures were introduced now for the elimination of Jews from the German economy. Decrees were introduced in the aftermath of the Kristallnacht, which excluded Jews from participation in retail stores, export mail order firms. They could not be independent craftsmen. Jews could not sell any goods or services. Jews could not act as managers of businesses. Jews could not become members of consumer cooperatives. And the Jewish community of Germany was assessed a 1 billion mark indemnity to pay for the damages of the Kristallnacht. The regime miscalculated on this as well. This is another one of the problems of translating ideology into policy, because within a week after the government announced with great fanfare that the Jews were to be forced to pay for the violence that they had provoked, the way the Nazis put it, German insurance firms began complaining to the government that these Jewish shops and Jewish homes were all insured, and that, quote, Aryan insurance firms were now going to have to pay off, so the indemnity wouldn't be paid by the Jewish community at all, but rather by these Aryan insurance firms. And so a tremendous mess ensued. Once again, an attempt to do something to implement ideology led to a pragmatic problem in the short term. But the real question now was that Jews had been deprived of their citizenship, been forced to the edges of the German economy. The question was, what sort of future was in store for the Jews of Germany? What, from the regime's point of view, what now to do with the Jews? As Reinhard Heydrich, the official in the SS who was in charge of formulating possible responses or solutions to the so-called Jewish problem, Heydrich remarked, there's only one problem that remains, and that is, namely, how to kick the Jews out of Germany. Between 1935 and the end of 1938, the SS had gradually assumed a greater and greater role in thinking about possible solutions to this so-called Jewish problem. Within the SS, a special department, the so-called Sicherheitsdienst, or security service, headed by Reinhard Heydrich, had been charged with thinking in a programmatic way about these questions. Within the department, within the Sicherheitsdienst, or security department of the SS, there were specialists for Catholics, specialists for Social Democrats, specialists for Communists, specialists for Jews, a Jewish desk, if you will, within the SD. A special desk on Orthodox Jews, assimilationists, and Zionists. And the SS, but particularly the SD, now regularly concerned itself with possible solutions to the Jewish question. In late 1938, in the aftermath of Kristallnacht, Goering, and initially Hitler, favored the idea of ghettoization, is the way it was put. Encourage Jews to leave Germany, but if that doesn't work, the collecting of Jews in ghettos in the major cities was discussed. This was rejected by Himmler and by Heydrich as unworkable, that these ghettos would be hotbeds of disease, crime, and corruption, as they put it, that would infect the surrounding society. They also rejected the idea of using the existing concentration camps in Germany. By 1938, there were seven different camps inside of Germany with an inmate population that by this point was under 20,000. People had been moved into concentration camps and then out. But the concentration camps were still seen by the SS, which was in charge of the concentration camp system. The concentration camps were still seen primarily as prisons for political prisoners and not yet considered a realistic solution to the Jewish problem. Between 1935 and the outbreak of the war, the SS clearly favored immigration. Indeed, the SS looked favorably on Jewish immigration, especially to Palestine. The Sicherheitsdienst continuously drew distinctions between Zionists and assimilationists within the Jewish community, favoring the former while harassing and persecuting the latter. The SS publication, the Schwarze Korps, drew distinctions between these different groups within the Jewish community. I quote, "The Zionists adhere to a strict racial position, and by immigrating to Palestine, they are helping to build their own Jewish state," close quote. The Zionists, therefore, in Germany, tended to be less persecuted, less badgered by the SS, the Gestapo, and the other police elements of the state. Hitler is not on record on this issue. There certainly is no written position of Hitler on what to do in the late 1930s with regard to the Jewish question. An official government, a government official did report in 1937 that Hitler had concluded that Jewish immigration should be encouraged and concentrated on Palestine because, quote, "this would create only one center of Jewish trouble in the world," close quote. The result was that between 1935 and the outbreak of the war, the policy in Germany was primarily one of Entjudung, immigration. But increasingly after November of 1938, immigration was really expulsion. Particularly after the Anschluss with Austria, which we'll talk about in the next session, the problem would grow more and more acute. A new office was established, the Central Office for Jewish Immigration, established in Vienna, and headed by a man who already had a career on Jewish affairs within the security service. That man was Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann would head the Central Office for Jewish Immigration, first in Austria, and later take that position within the SS, and would take it into occupied Europe when the war drastically changed the unfolding of Nazi racial policy.